We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling. Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey.
And thanks for listening.
Well, it's hard to imagine, Nick, but this podcast marks 7 months of the Act of Storytelling.
Wow, here we are, 7 months. Do we get a cake?
Sure, we can get a cake. Are you making the cake?
Yeah, 8 months. Maybe we'll do it for 8 months.
Yeah, we'll think about it.
We're going to get stuck into this podcast, but I did want to talk. We've talked a little bit about how we use this start section, and we've both got stories, me and Lauren, and this is the Act of Storytelling. So we thought what we could do is, rather than talk about bullet points, about what we've been up to and where we're
ramble
going.
Ramble on.
And ramble on like we normally do.
Which we know you love.
Which, yeah, correct. We thought we could talk about our own stories and a theme that has popped up for us this particular month. So, Lauren.
Well, I sort of looked at my month from the angle of what's worked for me this month. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of great art this month, theatre, film and visual art. And also I've been touring Summer of the 17th Doll. And something that came out for me is what we reflect in the stories that we tell, what the questions that we're asking. That is my theme.
What we reflect on the stories we tell?
In the stories we
tell. In the stories we tell. Okay.
The theatre that I saw just after we recorded our last podcast was Grounded at Red Stitch.
Yes, I've heard so much about this.
Which was really amazing, and I just want to mention it here. It's an American play written by Kirsten von Biebra, which follows one woman, an F-16 fighter pilot who loves the sky. She talks about how she loves the blue and she loves her job. She also falls in love and gets pregnant. And when she returns to work, she finds herself manning a drone. The drone is in Pakistan and she's 12 hours a day sat in a control room in Las Vegas looking at what this drone sees on a grey screen.
A very real concept for now, isn't it?
And some of the reviews say things like, a beautiful, necessary and perfectly structured solo drama and one of the greatest performances you're likely to see on Australian stage this year. Raw, nuanced and heart-wrenchingly visceral. They're completely right.
Yeah.
But it was a stunning performance by Kate Cole. We talk about the importance of art in posing universal questions about how we choose to live and reflecting society back at us, questioning our global responsibility, and this show did that for me.
It's such a big issue. I mean, there's a couple of things here which I love. First of all, a woman as an F-16 pilot, which we don't see enough of these days, a powerful woman, beautiful role. The second is this idea of drones, which is going to filter into our life more and more and more. And that whole idea of responsibility, as far as you can be 12 hours or, you know, miles away from where something's happening, but there's still a responsibility, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Just because you can't see the person eye to eye doesn't mean there's not a responsibility.
Which is, you know, I love the way you say that. It's such a mirror. There's all sorts of stuff that happens in the world that we're aware of or that we see on a screen, but it is so far away that we choose not to integrate ourselves.
We don't have to engage.
Yeah, that's one of the pieces of art this month. Next is a great film. I posted about this on our Facebook site, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, screened recently at Nova and also at Splendor. And it's by a UK-based Australian filmmaker called Thomas Meadmore, and it's his first feature-length documentary. He is a very passionate individual who is completely driven to tell stories through film. And the film looks at filmmaking, being a musician, both his boss and his girlfriend are musicians, following your dreams, whatever profession you're in, whether you're a musician or an actor or an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
What stops us from achieving them and what continues to drive us?
Mm-hmm.
Do these themes sound familiar?
Yes, ring very true.
Our relationships with people around us and how we shape our own stories. You know, that idea of Thomas talks about it quite a bit in the doco, that idea of the effect that he was trying to have on the audience.
Yeah.
And we can only make the film or tell the story. We can't choose how people are affected by it.
Yeah, it's so true. And I'm going to talk a little bit later in our review because the Melbourne Writers Festival is coming up and there is a beautiful, beautiful workshop that will talk to that exact thing. So we'll talk a bit later in the podcast to
okay,
that.
Okay, fantastic.
That's beautiful. Lovely
and of
link.
Course, I'm also working at MIFF at the moment, so I'm seeing some amazing films there. The other piece of art is a visual art exhibition. So we were in Warrnambool this week for one of the Summer of the 17th
The Bull
shows. Yeah, in The Bull. And they have a fantastic art gallery there, which we managed to sneak in a visit to. And I'm so glad we did because I got to see the beautiful and confronting Wonderkama Cabinet of Wonders exhibition by Sydney artist Rod McRae. And through his exhibition, Rod investigates how art can influence and reinforce the environment and climate change debate.
Okay.
He uses taxidermy. I always find taxidermy a little unnerving.
Yeah.
He's working with ethically sourced specimens. There's polar bears, zebras, lions, foxes, penguins, insects.
Ethically sourced. That is an interesting concept too of how you would even obtain.
Yeah, I don't know much about, but you know, clearly he has some very strong messages. And so he's creating installations to challenge human perceptions of the natural world and the non-human species that inhabit it. There's a lion on a bed on its back, sort of rolling around in this playful position. And he wanted to put the lion in a submissive posture. You know, all of his work, there's a bit of text that goes with each piece. There's some animals that their heads have been removed and in place he's put a mirror. So, of course, when you look at them, you see yourself.
You see yourself. Powerful.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah. Art affecting change is what that is. And that's beautiful. And
again,
is it doing a tour or is it just...
I think it had an exhibition at the Incinerator in Melbourne last year. It's now down in Warrnambool until November. And he's a Sydney artist. I'll find out where it's going next, what its future is, because, again, this idea of this responsibility... We do or don't take.
Strong theme. So get down to the Bull. Go for a road trip down to the Bull. Why not?
And then, of course, the last sort of piece of the puzzle for me this month has been my life as a working actor. Of course, I rehearsed and toured Ray Lawler's Summer of the 17th Doll with Complete Works. Talking about universal themes in art and what we reflect back. This is such an amazing Australian play that's universally considered to mark a turning point in Australian theatre history. It's set in the 1950s and was first performed, 1950s, post-war. It was the first play written in the Australian vernacular and the first opportunity for people to see ordinary working class Australian characters on stage and obviously thereby a reflection of themselves.
Yeah.
Not to underestimate the importance of this because at the time they would have seen British and American plays on stage, you know, in the received Queen's English. So to people to see themselves on stage and the questions that Ray Lawler asks through his script, you know, he's looking at aging and how that changes us and loss of identity. And I'm just so excited. It's on the VC syllabus. It came on last year. It's on for a few years. And after every performance, the kids are so engaged.
Mm.
They've studied the text in class, but to see plays aren't meant to
bring
be read.
Bring it to life. Yeah.
And to see these characters brought to life and to understand their emotional journey, it's completely different. So a shout out to my wonderful fellow performers, Justine Campbell, Philip Cameron Smith, and Philip McInnes. It's been a great month. And this idea of what we reflect back and the questions that art asks us.
Oh, that was great, Lauren. I really enjoyed that. It's so true, isn't it? These beautiful ideas that we can affect change, you know, in through art.
It reminds us why we tell stories.
It's exactly what it is. So thank you so much for that.
So what worked for you?
Well, I'm going to change tact a little bit and talk about health. And I guess health is a storyteller and the mind-body connection. Now, I didn't talk about this in the last podcast. I actually took a month off alcohol and caffeine just before we recorded our last podcast. Now, the reason I did that, it was a little bit because I was so busy and I thought, look, I just don't need this in my life. It was quite funny taking that time off and feeling better, going to the gym, doing yoga, meditating, doing all these beautiful things. Oh, thank you. He's just looking at my guns there, eh? trying to make a serious point here, Lauren.
Sorry.
But no, it was actually quite amazing, the transformation. The first 2 weeks were hard. There's no doubt about that. Once I got past that, it was this beautiful clarity of mind. I felt stronger both physically as far as stamina and stronger in the mind, which allowed me to do so much more in my day. And I was And it sounds weird, but there was also this deeper connection to my emotions as well.
Wow.
Now, while it did level me out, because caffeine, you know, is one of those things that I like to call borrows energy. So you use the energy directly after your coffee, and then at some point later in the day, it takes it from you. You know, so you have that crash. Whereas I had more of a leveled out day, but I also found that I found deeper connections to the emotions that I was feeling rather than letting, I guess, the external substances affect it.
It's interesting, though, if you talk about balance, you said that you're also doing yoga and going to the gym and meditation. And I guess it's that idea of it's great to cut stuff out so that if you reintroduce it, you're aware of its impact and in a really positive way when you do reintroduce those things. Mm. If you've also formed new habits of or reinvigorated habits of going to the gym and meditating and that, it's about the balance.
Correct. And let's talk about that because I had my month. And then I said, you know what? Let's bring coffee and alcohol back into my life. And I crashed. And like I am now, I got a cold, right?
Yeah.
There's this balance, right, that I will find. Because at the end of the day, do I want to cut out alcohol and coffee? No. You know, that's my personal choice. People may want to. But there's something about that that helps me zen out, do my job, whatever you want to look at. So what I wanted to talk about is that idea of moderation, because I came back off the month and sort of went a bit hard on the coffees and whatever. There's a great book that talks about 16 failures of highly effective people.
Oh.
And it's a book that I want to talk about. It's by Simon Reynolds, who is an Australian entrepreneur. And he talks about caffeine being one of the biggest ones. And he uses that idea of borrowing energy. And also because he says it scatters your brain. He goes, you can't have a great train of thought. And I think especially with acting, you know, we think of it like, oh, you know, we might just smash a coffee before that audition and give us energy or something ridiculous like that. And what it actually does, it mentally, it also scatters your brain and you find it harder to find a through line, I guess, for your brain. So something that I've certainly thought about over the last month, I mean, I like to be healthy, but it's finding that moderation and also not finding things that I lean on, like caffeine. So, you know, not leaning on something to get me through, like going, oh, I've got to record the podcast, I better have a coffee.
Which again comes back to taking responsibility, you know, on a much smaller scale. But
exactly.
Yeah, taking responsibility for your life and the choices you make.
Yep.
And reaching your goals.
Does this sound weird? But finding control so that you can have freedom.
No, I like it.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So finding control in
yourself. Control in a healthy way rather than in an obsessive, I have to control things way. Like a healthy, balanced control.
Sounds like a Buddhist term, but you know you know exactly what I mean. That's good. I'm not going crazy. So that's my thing.
Well, we both are.
Here we are. We both are sitting together, recording a podcast, going crazy.
Thank you for joining us.
So without further ado, let's get stuck into it. Let's get stuck into our storyteller for this month, Lauren, who is the wonderful Beau McCafferty.
He has an eye for eccentric talent, is obsessed with Bob Dylan, and is a huge supporter of independent arts in Melbourne. So let's hear from the man himself.
All right, here we are at the wonderful Fox Hotel with Beau McCafferty. How are you going, Beau?
Good evening.
Hey, Beau, it's lovely to see you.
It is lovely to see the both of you. Thank you for having me on.
So we are in your hood in Collingwood at the Fox Hotel. Tell us why you chose the Fox Hotel.
As I think I was saying to you before, it's a comfortable, local, trusted venue. It's important to be in a bar.
Well, Beau, we want to hear a bit more about you at the start of the podcast. So can you share your story with us?
I guess it's best to start at the beginning. I'm the youngest of three children. My dad's from Scotland and my mum's half Scottish. My family growing up was very, very working class in outer suburban Melbourne. When we moved there when I was about four, it was a small country town.
Yeah, right.
And very quickly by the time I was in high school, it had just been swallowed up by suburbia, by the huge conglomeration of housing estates as far as the eye could see. Yeah, so that's kind of where I grew up. What I felt was a bit of an unnatural environment. So I grew up in this environment where, as I say, it was basically houses as far as the eye could see. It was neither rural nor city. It was this kind of thing stuck
in between,
in the middle, with none of the benefits of either one of those. I recall realizing around the age of about 11 or 12 just how small-minded and insular that world was. And I think with my dad coming from Scotland and having traveled through Europe a lot, that most of his life and the stories he told kind of didn't match with the life and the environment around me. So whilst I would definitely not say that I had an unhappy childhood at all. I had a very, very happy childhood. I do think I spent most of high school desperately wanting to get away and to get out of that and to go and feel what the rest of life has to offer. Probably not an unusual feeling whatsoever. No. Probably most of the people around me had a similar inkling. I was involved when I was growing up in maybe just around 2 high school musicals, but I didn't have any acting or singing talent or anything really creative type outputs or pursuits until I was probably in around about year 11, year 12, where I got into fine art and got into photography, and I started to kind of found that really helped me through the final years of high school and to kind of find a path out of there. I went straight from high school to university, where I enrolled in a fine art photography course at art school. I often joke that I didn't get an education, I went to art school. I felt probably also like a lot of people at art school, like a bit of a fraud though, and that one day I would be discovered as having no real artistic ability and kind of be escorted off campus. And whilst I didn't excel at uni, I think I did become involved in all of the facets that art school life had to offer. And I got involved in lots of different parts of the campus. I found myself very, very involved with the music school and the kids in the music school and the filmmakers and the dancers and the actors and sculptors and painters and so on and so on. So yeah, I really, really made the most of being at uni whilst perhaps not making the most of being at uni, if you follow my lead. Post-uni life, I kind of bummed around for a few years and I didn't quite know what to do. I was still involved with a bunch of different art projects, but obviously needing to pay rent and make a living, and I wanted to somehow do that through my creative pursuits, but my photography or my fine art photography was never going to cut it. They didn't even teach us any of the practical skills you need to be a commercial photographer. It was very, very art theory based. So after a few years of kind of bumbling around, I went back to uni and I studied an arts management course, which I still find difficult to say out loud today. It just seems like an odd thing. I find it odd sometimes that an arts management course even exists, let alone the fact that I went and did one. I did enjoy whilst I was at uni. I really, really enjoyed the back end of things. I was involved with the student union and putting on a lot of exhibitions and getting involved in the other schools and helping people develop work and get their first show up. And I think that was what was playing on my mind when I decided to go and kind of study arts management stuff. As I said, I'd always enjoyed putting on things and learning how to best present and produce work and get it in front of the biggest audience possible. Yeah. I was also involved in making a film at the time that I went back to study, and making a film is basically like setting up a company. So it just made a lot of natural sense to go and kind of, yeah, do a theoretical, almost business type course involved with the arts. After I graduated from that, I knocked on a hell of a lot of doors with no success whatsoever, but finally managed to get myself like a 2-day-a-week admin job at the Next Wave Festival. And that's just, the first domino. And from then on, I've been working in festivals and arts organisations for the last 10 years, basically. I am currently programming, presenting and producing contemporary performance works across a couple of venues and multiple art forms. I do that for a council. So I now work with kind of theatre, dance, hybrid art, comedy, circus, and at my lowest point, I deal with cabaret shows.
Ouch.
And so I think as I wrote to you, I have been working in the arts industry for 10 years now, but I still feel like I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. Well, that's kind of, my story, at least in terms of being a storyteller or helping people tell their stories.
That's fantastic. So you talk quite a bit about, you know, what it was like for you growing up and that you're in a very, very working class suburbia atmosphere. Do you think that either hindered or attributed to your creative drive?
I think that a bit of both. Whilst I grew up in a very working class family, my father had travelled a lot and there were books at home all the time and we were encouraged at least to follow our creative pursuits.
Yeah.
Not overtly, not hugely. I was never sent to art lessons or,
right.
But I wasn't, I was subtly encouraged is the way I think of it,
yeah.
by my parents to pursue, the more creative stuff rather than necessarily getting told, no, you've got to go get a job,
yeah.
Or what are you doing with your life or any of that.
And talking about when you were growing up, because we did have a phone conversation a while back where you were talking about this idea of suburbia and that Triple J was such a foreign concept or a wacky concept for you at the time in that suburban area where you just thought, surely there's more to life than just, I guess, straight and narrow. And Triple J maybe introduced that to you a little bit. And that's why maybe the moves came to the mainland, if you will.
Yeah, it's funny. My dad would play Triple R at home. And I had an older brother who was a couple of years older than me who would listen to, I guess, alternative radio. And I recall by the time it came to the later years at high school where we have a common room, and all the students are allowed to have that space at lunchtime, and there was a radio in there, I wouldn't dare put on, say, Triple R or PBS or any of the independent radio. The closest I would do is I would put on Triple J. But that was still considered, that got banned. None of the other kids wanted to listen to it. It was such a ridiculously mainstream type white bread environment to be in. And I remember a lot of frustration thinking, God, if Triple J is as far out as some of the kids will sometimes go, then this is a pretty stifling environment.
Yeah.
So I know you mentioned at the end of your story that you're still not sure what you want to be when you grow up. Did you have any idea at that point in your time what you thought you might end up doing with your life?
Well, I'm still not sure that I want to grow up for a start. No, I definitely thought that I wanted to be in the creative realm. I definitely thought that failing being a rock star, which, I mean, it's not off the cards entirely, even now, that I would try and follow a passion.
Was there influences at that time as far as whether it be family or anyone that sort of influenced you?
Absolutely not. In terms of following your passion, I felt like the world was
against you.
It was closed. Yeah. All the doors were closed, and I didn't know how one would go about doing anything. It was
right.
My dad worked in a factory. My mum worked at a bank.
Where did this come from then? Where did this artistic flair come from? What do you think the spark was?
Well, no, I think my dad is a hell of a lot more of an artistic person than I am.
Yeah.
And my brother and sister even did a lot more probably creative things growing up than I did. I recall them my family laughing at me when I got into art school, kind of saying, "You're the least artistic person here." In the family. Like it was encouraged at home to do these things, but for a career or. Yeah, there was no clear path of how to go about things.
Yeah.
And so I didn't understand the way, say, for instance, the music world worked. When I first went to university, I had a lot of friends in bands, but I just didn't have the slightest clue about how band A would go about getting a song on the radio or getting a record out or what music publishing was or what an agent did as opposed to a manager.
Yeah.
So a lot of my first kind of years away from or moving out of deepest, darkest suburbia was trying to understand the way the world worked, at least in terms of the creative industries.
And so do you think in a way those years following university when you were a bit lost and you were just kind of floating around, do you think that was instrumental in the next step towards being a curator or this sharing art? But do you think there's something in that idea of being lost that helps you figure out the next part of the puzzle?
That's interesting. I read an opinion piece a while back by the playwright Annie Rayson, and she spoke about her time, I believe it was at the VCA when she studied there, to just have a year to not do anything or not have a specific project as such or like research basically, but being a bit lost and floating around, and how instrumental that was to her and how needed it was. And I think that myself, I should have. In hindsight, I should have taken a gap year or two or three. I went straight from high school into art school.
Right.
And so I graduated when I was, 21, 22. God knows if I had anything to say about the world at that age.
Yeah.
I often think that I would get a hell of a lot more out of doing the course now than I would have when I was younger.
Yeah.
But I needed to do the course when I was younger to be
That's
who
right.
I am
Where you
now.
Are now. Yeah, yeah.
I have a theory, or I remember I used to peddle this theory quite a bit. I believe that there should be national service, that people should either go to art school or the army.
Wow. Or work in hospitality. I reckon people should work in hospitality for 3 months at least.
It probably wouldn't work for too many years, but basically you set it up that everyone who says they want to go into the army has to go to art school, and everyone who wants to go to art school gets sent to the army.
Good.
Everyone needs to learn how
who
to dig
to
a ditch.
Who goes to hospitality, if that's the case then? We all need to know how to make a drink, don't we?
Yeah.
But I get you. So you need to see the other side of yourself. Is that what you're saying?
You need to challenge yourself and your perspective on the world. And even though I think I grew up with a fairly open mind, going to art school was still a massive challenge to me, and I opened my mind to a million different ideas.
And let's talk about those million ideas, because you've got strings to your bow. Let's talk about it. Photography, music, and film are probably three of your passions that are really important to you as a storyteller and creative. What's your first love out of those three, and why?
Well, I do find it funny that I work in the performing arts, yet my background is initially visual arts and music and then film. I would actually say that I think photography was my first proper passion, although I grew up listening to music every minute of my life. I was obsessed.
Yeah.
Absolutely obsessed with your classic kind of 60s and 70s music idols, like, you know, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
But I didn't see, maybe because I don't have any musical talent. I taught myself guitar when I was about 15, 16, and I'm really, really, really bad at it. And I think because of the frustrations I found around that, I didn't really think that music was going to be my path in life, at least creatively. But I did early on get a handle on photography and how to manipulate it, or how to be in control of the form.
Yeah.
And I think that being in control of the form enables you, obviously, to then, whatever, break the rules or to...
Yeah.
There was a frustration around playing guitar, not getting the sounds out of it that I wanted to make, not playing the song that I wanted to be able to play. And I think it's the same. Well, I think it's true for most artistic avenues, is that you want to be, or you need to be able to kind of see results when you manipulate it, or when you attempt to do it do it in different ways. I figured out photography pretty early on, or got results from it.
Yeah, it was a natural talent that came.
I wouldn't say natural, but I worked hard on it, and that's really important in encouraging yourself to go on.
Yeah,
you know, if you hit a plateau, as you might be, as you know, as a dancer or an actor or whatever, and you don't see any significant change, and yet you're putting in a lot of effort, I think it leads to a lot of burnout, and that's why most people end up leaving.
Yeah, you've got to see a light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, from where you're going.
Yeah,
as an
you're
going to
see a bit more light after a bit more tunnel, you know.
That's a really interesting view, given your acknowledgement of how obsessed you've been with music. And it's fair to say, I believe, that you're a massive Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan fan. In fact, you have a Bob Dylan tattoo on your left arm.
Yes.
I think, have I got
yes.
that right?
Yes, indeed.
And how many times did you see Bruce Springsteen in concert?
In all, I've seen him 9 times, but we were saying before, in the last year, I saw him 8 times.
What makes their work so special to you?
This podcast doesn't have enough time to cover even the slightest fraction of my thoughts on the subject. I'll just say that I think, as well as being exceptional writers, they are also incredible performance artists in and of their own right. And there's a lot going on stage.
Mm.
And maybe these days Bob Dylan doesn't get enough credit for it, but throughout his career, his live work has been as much of a performance art kind of action as it has been about the lyrics.
Especially those early days too. I mean, his live performances were, in fact, a part of a protest, weren't they, really?
Yeah, and then he would go on to kind of completely revolutionise the form of pop music and stage and stage performance, and constantly challenging his audience and himself, and analysing personas and performance theory, and just kind of encompassing the full gamut of, how do I put it, really, really investigating what it is to perform on stage, not simply I'm walking out on stage to play a song.
And that's a serious love for the point you're trying to get across, and a love of what you do, isn't it? And is that something that you think's really important in what you do as well, like in your life, that idea of I have to love what I do?
I read an interesting article recently which was talking about how there's a lot of pressure to be passionate and love your day job, and how maybe it's a crock of shit.
Right, really? Okay, so you're feeling a bit on
that. And not everyone's going to be able to do that. And you're not a failure if you're doing that. Or your job is maybe not necessarily... If you make tables, maybe you make tables. Maybe there are people who are master craftsmen and really, really get into the finer details of the... But sometimes you're actually just making a table, and that needs to be fine. I think the industry that we're in dictates you've got to be passionate. So many other people waiting to kind of step into... To your role, if who are more passionate than you are, perhaps. But there's also an exploitation that goes on around the fact that because people are so passionate, they're willing maybe for less money, or they're willing to take, they want to take that opportunity over the top of someone else. There's a lot more cutthroat.
Double-edged sword, isn't it?
A lot more cutthroat. And I feel that, it is extremely important to be passionate about the work that you do, but I have been in a lot of arts organisations where I think that exploitation of people's passion has been a really, really negative influence. And so I'm always reluctant to try and say that that is the, like, a defining characteristic when hiring someone or when looking to bring another person into the team.
But it is that thing. We had a storyteller called Paul Edwards a couple of weeks ago, and there was this whole thing about his wife when he was at the office at 3 a.m. basically calling him and saying, "You're not a brain surgeon. Like, it can wait to the morning. There's nothing that has to be done right at this minute. So please come home and spend time with your wife," was basically what she was saying. So I find that line, isn't it? It's about going, I'll do all I can, but at the same time, I've got to live my life.
I work with the fantastic arts publicist, Michelle Buxton, a fair bit.
Yes.
And she said something to me, just even maybe late last year, whereby we had a whole bunch of dramas around a particular show that we're putting on. And at the end of it, she just goes, "Oh, well, it's only art. No one died." And I'm like, yeah. And so sometimes I've been using that this year. I keep on saying to people, it means when things are getting really stressful, "Oh, it's all right. It's only art." And this look I get back from people like, "How dare you? What do you mean it's only art? It's just life and death."
But, you know, in the context of things, you're not a brain surgeon, so taking that time.
So, in your current role at the Darabin Art Council, I imagine it's quite a different atmosphere to working at Melbourne Fringe. Mm. And you've got quite a diverse community in Darabin. How do you create a program for such a diverse audience?
Very interesting question, one I can ramble about for a long time. The programs that I was hired to run were very, very specifically about, here's the buzzword, activation of space. Activating the two venues that Darabin have, which were seen as being very much underutilised, the Northcote Town Hall and the Darabin Arts Entertainment Centre. And that was very specifically what my role was to do, to run some development stuff, as well as presentation to get more bums on seats, more artists and companies engaging with it, and developing awareness of the venues. But then when you look at the council's wider goals of actually engaging with those at-risk communities and communities that not currently engaging with the arts, they're not necessarily goals that directly align with each other. For instance, a lot of culturally diverse communities that are in Darabin just don't have it within their regular culture to go to a traditional theatre space and sit down and watch a show. That's not to say that that's necessarily just the migrant communities. It could just even, like, a lot of the working class communities from, say, Reservoir, just don't have it. They're not interested in going and watching a play in a traditional theatre setting. They've got other pursuits, they've got other interests. So overall, within the Darabin Arts Department, there are a whole bunch of programs that each one kind of targets a different area. And so, fortunately, they're not trying to fit the round peg into the square hole and say, hey, with our theatres, with these programs, go and engage with the ageing Chinese population, which is one of the fastest growing populations that Darabin has.
Yeah, right.
Fortunately, they're going, okay, across all of our programs that Darabin Arts have, which ones can service these communities? Having said that, I think I've been very, very fortunate in that so much of the programming we've put on naturally has been quite representative of a very, very diverse community.
Yeah.
And more often than not, we're sitting down after we program, say, the next 6 months ahead or the next year ahead. We sit back and then we go through the kind of tick boxes the boxes that we're supposed to tick and go, oh, okay, so how many of these are Darabin residents? How many come from a kind of culturally diverse background? And it's already happened. Like, it happens, I think, without a conscious overlaying of going, let's meet these quotas up front.
Yeah.
We do check. We go, hey, who's not in the room? And luckily, at least so far in the last 2 years, I think it's representative of the people who are currently working at Darabin, though. We're interested in the people who aren't normally in the room. And so that's what's...
And does that involve now reaching out to certain communities as well and collaborating with them? Do you find that's a first step in the process of going, okay, what are these areas in the community that we need to target and how can we reach out?
Well, it's been a little bit tough to get it happening quickly, but in terms of not helicoptering in something from outside and going, here's a show, go and watch this. Or going, here's a company that works with, this is actually a discussion I was having today with my boss. There's a company that works with local communities in producing children's theatre, and they go and develop it within the community for a couple of weeks and then present it. And it's quite a remarkable show.
Yeah, great.
We're really, really interested in it. However, we're trying to weigh that up against a company that's already in our community that is run by people who live in the area and who will be embedded in the area for a long time to come afterwards.
Yeah.
And going, actually, even though we really, really love this project, we want longer-term outcomes for the people in the community.
There's so many different things you have to think about, isn't it? It's not just, hey, I really like your show, come and perform it.
So year-round, do you get to see a lot of performance? Or
I can't underemphasize enough how much time I spend in front of a spreadsheet or writing emails. That, to me, is I feel like it's
important.
My life.
Yeah.
However, the fun bits of the job and the best bits of the job are talking with artists and companies. And I have hundreds of artist meetings and company meetings a year and seeing as much work as possible. And it's actually not something that a lot of people in positions similar to mine get to do. I attend a lot of arts markets and conferences.
Yep.
And I get the feeling a lot of the time that a lot of the people who are responsible for making the curatorial decisions don't actually get to see a hell of a lot because they're so busy running everything else. And they only get to see a handful of works that are kind of put in front of them. And that's a great pity because it would be... And that's the pressures of having to wear so many hats. Mm. But it would be so wonderful if the people who were getting to choose the work or got to see all of the work.
Yeah. Well, it must take this other little reservoir of energy because you've got your day job and then you've got to go, wow, I've got to go see art. But I guess,
yes.
Where do you find that energy from, Bo? Where, is there a special little magical fountain? What is it?
No.
Is it a tequila bottle?
No. That's the opposite. That will take your energy.
Yeah.
Look, I think I used to say in one of my jobs that somebody needed to be able to go home and have a baby and still continue working in the organisation, and that the fact that that clearly wasn't going to be able to happen in terms of the demand of hours upon everyone, that in this particular organisation was saying this is a real problem, and that we're almost wishing somebody got pregnant or their partner got pregnant or whoever, and that got brought to a head so that there wasn't this constant expectation that not only were you at work all day, that was going on into the late night and for 5 or 6 nights a week. Rant over.
Well, if we talk about the things that you do have time to do or that you are lucky enough to have time to do, shall we talk about Denmark?
I'm so excited for this part of the podcast. This is Lucy Guerin's Untrained.
Yes.
Where... it's a visual delight that showcases 2 trained dancers and 2 untrained dancers. Now, Bo, which category would you fit into for that?
I'll let you figure that one out.
Okay. But it's basically an exercise in presenting the body's unique abilities. How did you get involved? Talk us through the process. How?
Well, having never been on stage myself, except for the, you know, 1 or 2 high school musicals I was involved in, I was pressured into it. Some of my colleagues at work pointed out that they had done a call out. They'd advertised an audition for they retire out the untrained performers in that particular show every couple of years
because they lose the ability to then be untrained. Is that
More that they become more performative and more comfortable on stage. Yep. And loses the kind of, I guess, the spontaneity that they're after and a bit of the rawness. It's not that they suddenly can pirouette a lot better. They're not, as I come to understand it, it's not that they are looking for the 2 most incompetent dancers that they can find.
No. I'm sure
that's what you tell yourself.
That's what I tell myself when I go to sleep at night. But it's about being able to express your personality on stage.
Because it's not just the physical side of things.
There's a fair bit of talking, and some of the physical movements aren't dance movements per se. One of my favorite sections in the show is you need to go on and act like a cat that gets electrified. This is also apparently one of the audience highlights of every show, and that's the one that gets most commented on. It's a very, very, very fun show. But for me, auditioning and being a part of the audition process was all I was interested in doing initially. I didn't expect to get through.
That was the challenge for yourself.
But I thought, I work around these poor actors and dancers all day long, and I've never so much as been through an audition process. I'm going to do it. When I was encouraged, I'm like, I'm going to do it to put myself in their shoes and just step onto that other side of the fence and see what it is.
Is there a new appreciation?
Part of the performance process.
Yeah, what was it like?
It was terrifying. Initially, it was great because all of the guys were... Well, none of them were really performers. So everyone's really, really supportive of everyone else in the room. There was over 50 of us in the room for the day of the audition. When it would come time, so about after an hour and a half or so, they culled half of the people there.
Wow. But the people serious who dance got audition.
Yeah, but the people who then had to leave, like, we clapped them out of the space. And there was cheers and there was applause.
You have been evicted from the house.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a lot of backslapping. And when we were asked to do these instructions kind of one by one, for instance, walk into the middle of the stage and talk about a physical insecurity that you have, there was such support for it. It felt like such a caring environment.
Yeah.
even though it was 50 plus strangers.
Yeah.
Because you're all in the same boat.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're all in the same boat. But then as the audition process went on and I made it past the next cutoff and the next cutoff, it got down to about 12 of us. And I was like, oh, I want this bad. Yeah, I will push any of you under a bus.
Very good. That's it. You became part of the process. You
yeah,
you
then
it.
I was, I'm in. Like,
so how long till you're off to Denmark?
I fly in about 10 days, which is very, very scary because we haven't even started rehearsals yet.
Oh, so you start rehearsing over there?
No, we start rehearsing next week in Melbourne.
Surely there's a nice thing that you're the untrained dancer. Surely there's not that many rehearsals that you have to worry about.
There are only about 5 full days of rehearsals.
Okay.
But I've got a lot of homework before I get in there.
Yep.
There's a whole bunch of...
Cat, electrified cat homework.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. We might have a rendition of that for the Facebook page, if that's okay. We can post that just to see how it's all coming along, the electrified cat.
Yeah, we'll discuss that.
So in between all of this... all of your work and Denmark, you also find time to manage a band as well.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Oh. Time got in the way of that one. No, I was quite involved in the music scene for a while, and thankfully, the band that I used to manage broke up. Thankfully, they're all super successful in their other bands now.
Yeah, right.
So like the band broke up, and all of them are now kind of having lots of success in their other bands. They're all still very good friends. But I think, what's the phrase? Jack of all trades, master of none. I was very much stretched across far too many fields, fingering too many pies.
Can we talk about another field which you are not stretched over? Because you won an award for this, the DVD of Meredith.
Oh, yes.
A Weekend in the Country. You actually won
the
an
DVD,
award.
The DVD, you mean the documentary.
Yeah, documentary, sorry.
Well,
documentary.
It is available on DVD.
It is available on DVD.
All good DVD stores.
2006, you won an award at MIFF.
Voted
best documentary at MIFF 2006.
That's it.
Slight correction. It was voted best Australian documentary. Or we just got pipped at the post for overall by a little documentary called An Inconvenient Truth. So,
that old thing.
Screw you, Al Gore. That was brilliant. And as a straight ahead storyteller, that was, I mean, I my view what I do as a job is as enabling
sort of
others to
scenes,
tell their stories
yeah.
and telling stories within a program. But as this very specific artistic output of storytelling, that was probably the thing I'm most proud of. It's telling the story of not just the Meredith Music Festival, but also of the people who founded it and the main person who's... Yeah.
And you have quite a close relationship with them, don't you?
Yeah, and it kind of came about in a funny way. We were initially asked to put together a DVD of just the best live performances at Meredith. And in doing that, well, we were lobbying them to kind of do that.
Yeah.
And then once they kind of gave the green light to that, suggested as we got to know a bit more about the story behind the festival and how incredible it kind of was and touching it was, we said, well, we need to include this as like a DVD extra.
Yeah.
But as soon as we started the path of researching it and collecting interviews around it, it very quickly became apparent that this was going to be the focus of the whole project.
Yeah.
And so, that this was, yeah, in fact, a feature-length documentary, yeah, that needed to be told, and not some extra buried away on some obscure DVD.
And can you tell us a bit about that?
The Meredith Music Festival began actually before the Big Day Out. Kind of the same year. It was on maybe 2 months beforehand or 6 weeks beforehand. It started as a party on a farm for a group of friends, yeah, and there were no music festivals in Australia at the time, and it was really at the forefront of kind of, I guess, the independent music scene, and getting a lot of those bands together of diverse genres and getting them together on the one stage. And the guy who started it was, or the guy whose property it was on, was Chris Nolan, who, grown up, yes, his parents owned the farm, and he's studying law and met a couple of other dudes at Monash, I believe it was, and they got drunk every kind of night of the week, and when we get to a certain hour, they'd all start going, oh, what I'd really like to do is we should put on a music festival, we should put on a party.
Yeah.
And eventually he's just gone, bugger it, I've got the place and let's go and do this. And it grew into what is, you know, known as one of Australia's most cult, yes, favourite, beloved
still
festivals,
yep,
still. And unfortunately, after a few years, when it started to really take off, he got very, very, very sick. He went to Vietnam just when it was opening up to the West and got what they call a super bug. It's basically just like an infection overnight.
Oh.
Off a mosquito, or they don't know quite what, but the suspect is a mosquito, and it's like having a super strong flu, as it were, and it shut his organs down and put him into a coma. And he then ended up with, after being in a coma for 6 months, he ended up with an acquired brain injury, and he's locked in. So he's unable to talk, and he's unable to move, really, of his own free will, but he's fully aware. And his resilience over the years and his ability to now communicate in a couple of small kind of, well, small gestures for him, but the giant kind of like steps forward for him, and the fact that his parents still host the festival on their site every year.
It's a beautiful sentiment, isn't it?
And he's at every festival, and now for Golden Plains Festival on the same site, they have him out to open it every year. And he's friends with a lot of the musicians from back then as well. So I've been to a couple of concerts with him, like the Dirty Three, where, you know, it's reserved front row type kind of seating for him, and they all know him. And he was very involved in, I guess, pioneering this kind of independent music scene in Australia and celebrating it. And he's survived, and, you know, to this day, when most other people with his kind of injuries have, you know, have...
It's quite an amazing story, really, isn't it? And I guess...
Yeah, so it's a privilege to be able to tell his,
his story. Exactly.
And to kind of tell it in a way that I think we felt like it was a bit under the radar. A lot of people wanted to see the documentary. It was the first film of the whole festival, of the Melbourne International Film Fest, to sell out. We sold both our sessions straight away. And I remember seeing this queue around the block of people, and just feeling this massive kind of sense of achievement, but knowing that they were about to go in and not get what they thought was being, here's a bunch of bands that I really love, but actually get this backstory that shows the love and care and attention that's gone into that site. And I think that now, to this day, they write about Chris Nolan in the festival guide every single year. There's always a page or two dedicated to him, and he comes and he has his little stand up the back of the amphitheatre. And he comes to the festival, and people drop by to talk to him. All throughout, you know, strangers constantly coming up to him and telling him how much the festival means to them. And so to be able to give a bit, to flesh out his story a bit more and provide more of the background to it, has been, just, I think, the biggest storytelling success that I've certainly been a part of.
Are you still making films? Have you made any films since then?
No, I made a few film clips since then. My brother and I embarked on another documentary, but I think the complexities of music publishing and financing, we're doing another music documentary that is now kind of sitting on the shelf. I would say, however, that I think we still run, I guess, Meredith and Golden Plains YouTube channel, and I guess are in charge of a lot of the way that they communicate with the world online. And we've just racked up something ridiculous like 800,000 views for the clips that we put up. And the care and attention that we put into what we put online, or what we what we really want people to pay attention to. We don't necessarily put up the number one Triple J hit of summer who came and played at the festival. Quite often we go, actually, we know that the festival's quite keen to showcase this particular quieter story that was happening there, or this other. I think there was a Syrian refugee who came and played a couple of years back, and that was the one clip we definitely had to get out of the whole festival online and to show was the crowd going mental to this guy who had literally just escaped this kind of, you know, awful civil war and bombing of his home city. And so I don't know, that the way that we communicate and tell the stories from the festival has now changed.
Yeah.
I think the internet has completely thrown long form, necessarily
a little bit out the window, you think?
Long form storytelling of documentaries is just a bit
old school, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult to go and share a full documentary online on your Facebook page. Mm. Often it's much easier to go and share a bite-sized kind of
attention
chunk
span style. Yep. So, what do you think the key to good storytelling is? If we boiled it all down, is there a couple of key ingredients that make up a good story? And packaging that up and sharing that with people.
This is where I get to sound like an expert, where I definitely don't feel like what there isn't a golden rule, but I think in terms of what I try to do is that I always try to put myself in the audience's shoes, and be it in terms of giving feedback to somebody on the actual material contained within the type of art that they're trying to put on, or if it's around the way they're presenting it. And kind of how is the audience going to, from the moment they, how is the audience even going to find out about the work, to what is their experience when they turn up? Is it a welcoming environment? Does it feel elitist? Does they feel pushed back? Or are you expecting them to have a whole bunch of history of dance language or theatre knowledge? Or where are you giving them a place to stand within the work? Mm. And I think that enable to effectively communicate with an audience, you always need to be able to give them a place to stand.
Almost like the first step, like before you even go into anything, consider your audience.
Well, if you're not thinking about who you're telling the story to, it's almost, what's the point of telling the story?
I think that's a question, though, that you need to continually revert to. You know, you can get lost in the forest. What's another metaphor like that? You can't see the wood for the trees. You can get so lost within your own work that it's often difficult to realise the audience, where you think they've taken every step with you, may not have. And I'm talking about dumbing it down, but as I said before, I think the phrase that I often use is giving the audience a place to stand.
Yep.
I have a friend who's a wonderful, amazing playwright and director, and his work is always very, very dense and intellectual. And I feel embarrassed at times that my feedback to him so often is, it's not dumb it down, but don't expect that the audience has taken every leap you have.
Yeah.
Or if you are having this work that is really quite heavy and involved, and give us some spaces to breathe.
Yeah.
And don't be so utterly relentless, and just kind of, what is the experience of somebody who's not been to this kind of show before?
It's good advice.
So most of your roles for your work as a producer have seen you undertake great responsibility in the landscape of the Melbourne art scene, if not the wider Australian art scene. You yourself knocked on a lot of doors, in your own words, to get your break with the Next Wave Festival way back when. Having all the knowledge you now have, what would you say to up-and-coming artists about getting seen and developing their craft?
I got asked to go and speak to a group of artists maybe last year who were part of a development program, and so they were all fairly, it was a national program, but they were all still fairly young, but they'd been selected as being, I guess, elite at their young age. And I don't think I made any friends when I kind of said to them, this is it, this is the most back padding you're going to get for the rest of your career, probably. You've peaked. My advice to them was basically, it's hard work, and you can't rely upon external, necessarily, encouragement as your sole driver. I know a lot of artists who are quite successful, and I know some of those people I personally consider to have unbelievable loads of natural talent. Some of them have loads of talent that they've worked really, really, really hard to develop, and some of them, I think, are no-talent bums. And the one thing they all have in common, though, is that they work their ass off. They work and work and work so hard. And even the artists who I don't consider to have that much talent, who are hugely successful, get up, work for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on end, and take advantage of every opportunity that comes their way.
Yeah.
I chose to, like, we came to a bar tonight. I think that the bar is the most important location of any festival. More happens in a bar than happens anywhere else. That happens, true. Say, on a, like, in the discussions at a panel or on a round table or in the theatre for the rehearsal, or more networking, more deals are done, more relationships formed and probably broken up. More informal kind of relationships that then develop into something else happen in the social spaces. And that's why you have a festival as opposed to simply having, you know, shows one after the other in a venue. That's why it's really, really important for artists to gather and for everyone around those kind of who are involved in the creative process together, is the less formally structured meetings.
I totally agree with that. I reckon the festival bar, if you can get around a festival and get into a bar, the amount that you learn, the amount that you hear, the amount that can be constructed is so important. And by the way, that advice to them is great. They're probably all accountants now after hearing that. You scared them so much, but it's good advice. It is. The final question I have for you, Bo, today is, if you were curating your life to be a show at the Durban Arts Entertainment Centre, what kind of show would it be? Would it be dance? Would it be performance arts? Would it be stand-up comedy?
Cabaret.
Cabaret, maybe.
It'd be a fucking tragedy. I'm going to go with rock opera.
Rock opera?
Yeah, definitely.
I totally get that.
Yeah, killer soundtrack.
Bit of tight obscure. Pants.
Lots of tight Lycra. Pants. I can see it all.
Bit of a jumpsuit operation.
I'll swap you for your pants.
Where's your yellow jumpsuit, Bo?
Do you know that yellow jumpsuit actually used to be gold? It's
famous jumpsuit.
You are interested in so many different areas of the industry, but also as a curator, this idea of telling a story through the curation of other people's stories. It's fascinating to me.
It's a difficult thing, and I've definitely felt compromised at times. When I worked for the Melbourne Fringe Festival, I would have to program the Fringe Hub, so the collection of venues that the festival ran. There are a lot of needs, and, you know, variety of art forms, one variety of artists, of experience, of enabling some new artists to get into that space and have that platform, and not simply have it be a collection of very tried and true surefire audience friendly kind of shows.
That's the beauty of the Fringe, is the wider.
Yeah, but in making sure that it did cover a cross section of the festival as a whole, and that made it a whole lot more difficult to tell a specific kind of story of going, actually, we'd really love to throw a spotlight onto works by Indigenous artists or contemporary dance, and actually this year we think that physical theatre, circus is really, really hot, and we're gonna throw our resources to get behind them. So you could only do that in a lot more subtler ways. Whereas in my current role, there's a lot more license to be able to, I guess, tell more of a story with a full program, and to try and make a statement with it, and to say we think this type of thing is important for not just the artists but the audiences, and this is what we want to be focusing on. I think that you guys should really do a podcast with the guys from Mona.
Yeah, we're the way they can, to
the way they can grab.
That's a great idea.
Seemingly, and set up the gallery to showcase, you know, very, very seemingly disassociated works, and place them side by side. And this whole room is about, you know, is about death, or this particular journey you've gone on from up, you know, 400 meters that way to here is a particular path that we are very, very interested in. Juxtaposing these works next to each other.
Yeah, some serious thought goes into that. We will put that out into the ether to see if we can make that
happen. I love that you brought that up. We ran out of time. We'll have to stop recording and then ask all the other questions.
We always do this. I think our questions after the podcast are usually 2 hours worth.
Can we replace the early, like, boring answers I gave with later?
Yeah, we'll scratch your story.
Yeah, it'll just be me and Lauren talking.
Yeah, I made notes. I haven't looked at them.
Anyway, that brings us to the end of our interview. Thanks so much, Bo.
Thanks, Bo.
Thank you, guys.
Bo has retaliated and made us turn his mic back on. Over to you, Bo.
The floor is
yours. That's all right. I thought I was going to get asked a question on festivals, but because I worked in a bunch for so long, but you didn't ask me, so forget
which
about
question,
it.
Which question would you like us to ask you?
We did skip over the festival question.
Can you just give us the answer?
the question was, we love your thoughts on creating communities of artists and the importance of festivals in helping to foster great art. Have you got
interesting that? You should ask. I was going to say, there's a school of thought.
Make it good now.
I was going to say, there's a school of thought at the moment that says actually festivals are a bit antithetical to creating communities, and that festivals are so, particularly in a city like Melbourne, we're so saturated with them.
Yeah.
The kind of expectations that come around a festival and the kind of false way that audiences then kind of necessarily maybe engage with the work, as opposed to the way that they, this kind of expectation that you will behave in a set standard series of ways, and that the Melbourne festival means this or that.
Yep.
The, you know, the
so
the,
niche the, festivals almost.
Yeah, and well, it's just so saturated that it comes down to, there are four types of Spanish film festivals in Melbourne, you know, that, and each one has its own kind of particular branding on, no, we're different because of, we're the Spanish language film festival as opposed to the Spanish film festival. Maybe we've got enough festivals. And when I was, when I started my role, they said, okay, so what would you do to enliven these venues or get a lot more attention on these venues? I kind of felt like they were asking me to come up with a new festival, that focus would be on that, on one or two of these particular venues. And
because you have talked about geographical location and bringing artists together as a way of them creating more art, basically.
Yeah. Maybe, particularly in a city like Melbourne, where there is so much kind of constantly going on, stuff it. The most beneficial thing might actually be to say, no festival. And I don't know, if you were put in charge of a festival tomorrow, maybe the most beneficial thing to do, particularly if it'd been around for a while, is to rest the thing.
To shake things up a bit.
To rest the thing and actually not have it for a minute, and just a bit of pause, a bit of breath, and say, what happens when we don't put it on?
So you're taking an anti-festival stance here.
Are you taking an AJ Matter, no big day out?
No, I'm taking an anti-saturation point of view here.
Yep.
And that maybe even by not having it for a year, you would realise what's not there or what is more needed. I think the problem with a lot of festivals is that once they start to be on for a long time, there's an expectation built up about what it should be, as opposed to it not servicing the needs of the arts and the audience and those involved. It's that kind of, it's being led by the thing that should be following. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I wouldn't have expected that view from you.
It starts to generate its own rules. Well, I think that maybe because I was at Melbourne Fringe for a very, very long time, I felt the frustrations in it having these rules set up. And I think in my handover to my successor, Felix, who's doing a great job there, I continually said, every third sentence to him was, this is what we did, please feel free to throw it out the window. Like, I think, but it's true, I think, for a lot of festivals that have been about for a bit, is that there's an expectation that it gets set that it needs to be a certain way, and that's not necessarily healthy to...
Well, it's an anti-art perspective too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, art is not meant to stay the same. It's meant to evolve and change and comment in new ways.
Yeah, so it should be an ongoing conversation.
So should the festivals that curate that work.
Every storyteller that we have brings something completely different. And that time I really loved Bo's thoughts on the idea of think about your audience. Before you even start thinking about your through line for your show or any stuff like that, think about the experience that your audience will go through, and sometimes the fact that they might not be as far developed as you in regards to the creation of your show. So take them on the journey with you.
Yeah,
so I
rather
really
than
love
assuming
that.
They're there already.
Correct, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
So I really love that point. Did you have any takeouts from
well,
that?
Well, for me, it was sort of a running thing through the interview. You know, we asked him quite early on about how important is it to you loving what you do, and he talked about going home and shutting off and having time in your life for other things and not expecting people to just constantly be thinking about their jobs. And then, you know, he talked a lot about all of his varied passions, and then right at the end, after we'd ended the interview, he made us turn all the mics back on so he could tell us more about how he felt about art and shaping art, and it just made me smile because the man clearly has really abundant passion for what he does, and
that's
it's so important to him. And I think that's beautiful. Well, Well, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
What a great guy.
He is a great guy. I mean, I think already half of Melbourne knows that I love the guy, and he's fantastic. He's a massive supporter of independent arts within Melbourne, and that's a great thing. So love to hear from him every time.
Speaking of supporting the arts, have you got any recommendations for this month, Nick?
Yeah, I do. Actually, the Melbourne Writers Festival is coming up. It's happening from the 21st to the 31st of August. So a 2-week block there, and it is for writers, readers, and thinkers.
Ooh.
So I've had a bit of a look through their program and picked a couple of things that I think would be of interest to listeners as
Great.
Well, because they're of interest to me. So hopefully you enjoy. The first one I want to shout out to is Sound is the New Story, which is happening on the 23rd of August at Deakin Edge. And it's very relevant because it talks about oral storytelling, which is basically what we're doing here.
Podcasting.
Exactly. It talks to the rise of podcasting as a way of reporting and getting messages out to people and how storytelling via oral measures is changing. So I think it's well worth a listen. If you enjoy podcasting, get along and have a listen to the guys. It will be Benjamin Walker, who's US-based, Jesse Burrell, and Miyuki Jukiranta. I hope I got that right, Lauren. The next one I want to talk to is a masterclass which is happening around writing wicked characters. It's happening at the Wheeler Centre on the 29th of August.
Oh, I love the Wheeler Centre. They support all sorts of great stuff.
Yeah, so it's going to be great. It's with Alyssa Nutting. She's released a book called Tampa, which centres around a female pedophile.
Ooh.
And it offers a wicked insight into the dark world of writing baddies. What she talks about in this masterclass is the idea of creating a bad guy, but also not alienating the reader by making them so evil that you can't connect to them. So I think that's...
So it's more important to be able to relate to, or not sympathise, but relate to them somehow.
Yeah.
To be confronted by what's happening and ask real questions.
It's so important in storytelling, isn't it? Whether you're an actor, you need to find a way to make that character relatable so that they're not just a complete monster.
Absolutely.
As well as writing. You know, you want people to actually, in a way, root for the bad guy. Like you look at things like Breaking Bad, House of Cards, all have these what you could consider monster characters, but you've still got this thing that you feel for them, you know, that you want to follow them, you want to be a part of their journey.
Yeah, I've definitely with Breaking Bad, I didn't really sympathise with any of those characters, but you're still drawn to the story to see where it leads and to learn from it.
Well, you know, he had that whole thing about doing it for his family. And that started off as a noble cause, which then just got lost in the madness of the show. So there's a couple of beautiful things that you can go and watch as a part of the Melbourne Writers Festival from the 21st to the 31st of August. I did want to do a quick shout out too, because Edinburgh Fest has just kicked off. I wanted to tip our hat to the brave Aussies over there doing their thing internationally. And good luck, everyone. I hope shows are going well. Break a leg.
Great. Well, I've got a few recommendations too, some a little closer to home. The first one is A Lie of the Mind, which has just opened in a pop-up theatre in a warehouse. That seems to be a real Melbourne thing. Is that that whole pop-up idea thing?
Yeah, I think everything pop-up is Melbourne as far as we love that sort of idea of things are there and then they're not, you know? Finding the little bar in the laneway and then it's not
and
there the next
again.
Week. Yes.
And again, it's a play that deals with really intense universal themes.
Yeah.
It's a Sam Shepherd play who I think is
Sammy Shepherd. I love his work. I mean, I just love the ferocity of his work, and it's just so energy-filled, his work. So it's, Sam, bring it on.
And of course, the theatre company that is producing A Lie of the Mind, it's a collective of artists who've just got together, including the wonderful, I believe you know very well too, the Lauren Ann Kempster.
Yes, I do.
Who we've both performed with before, and some other fantastic people. But one of the things that I love that these guys are doing is they have on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, it's a pay what you can night, which I haven't seen a lot of in Melbourne. I think it's such an important idea, providing the opportunity for as many people as possible to come and see art and experience the work without being caught up in how much it costs. I think I'm very excited about that, and we'll put all sorts of links up on the site. Oh, just further to last month's podcast, our one to watch was the King's Collective in Sydney.
Yes.
And they've been working on their upcoming trilogy, Lepidoptera, an exploration of youth for the Sydney Fringe. And they've got a crowdfunding site, so I'll put a link online. But we're hoping to be in Sydney in the coming months for the podcast. So we'll talk more about them then, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity to check out their work firsthand. Of course, the month ahead for me, I'm about to head off on a trip to LA, New York, and then I'm finishing in London, which is super exciting. And I've frantically been planning that this month and just putting a shout out to all the people I know who've been to those cities.
And you're using it as a bit of an opportunity. You're using it as a holiday, but also an opportunity to meet up with artists, casting directors, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's so exciting. But also catching up with Trevor Olgate from the Inside Acting podcast.
Yes.
And I'm also hoping to talk to Sunya, who does the Another Aussie in LA podcast.
Oh, you're giving a lot of podcast love. Well, to our brothers and sisters out there in the podcast world.
Well, as she said earlier about the Writers Festival shout out, the whole thing about podcasting is creating these communities. So it's really exciting to be able to catch up with them. And then I've also got some training that I'm going to be doing in London. So maybe I'll just see theatre in New York. Maybe I'll just have fun there. Oh, and of course, in London, I almost forgot, we're doing our podcast, our next month's podcast recording.
Well, I'm travelling as well. So I'm going over to do a bit of work in Turkey. And lo and behold, our calendars meet and we're going to be in London at the same time. So we're kind of like when the Bradys did their show over in Hawaii. This is going to be like our little novelty show where we get to go to London and interview an Aussie in London.
We're currently looking into who we'll be interviewing, which is pretty exciting. We're setting our sights pretty high, so hope to get back to you on that soon. But of course, you know, there's so much happening around the world. Amazing Australians in all sorts of industries out there telling stories, so we can't wait to find out more about
it. It's actually really nice to send the act of storytelling international, isn't it?
Yes.
Still doing the Aussie
and
thing.
What other, you're not just in the UK, what other countries are you visiting?
Oh, so I'm doing obviously Turkey, going to do London, and at the moment we're thinking Greece as well, which Greece is literally for a bit of a holiday. Turkey is going to be interesting because I'm obviously there for my job as a creative producer. Unlike other times where you travel and it's a cultural thing where you're just trying to get by, this is another level on top where you're adding in the fact that you're working over there and cultural differences that you might find, and the language barriers that you might find in trying to get to the goal of what you need for your art. It's going to be a real challenge. I've never actually done a gig internationally. I have done gigs internationally, but not internationally in a sense of a place like Istanbul where
have
English...
Have you been to Turkey before?
No, first time.
Oh, what a treat.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
So I hear it's an amazing place of like old, old history and
so
then
much
beautiful
heritage,
modern. So it's that real infusion of both. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I just wanted to say one more thing. I wanted to talk a little bit about The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron.
Yes.
Do you know the book?
Yes, I do.
Have you ever had a go at it? So have you read the book, Lauren?
Someone gave it to me as a birthday present many years ago, and I did get started on it, the daily journaling, and I got into it a bit, but I think at the time I wasn't probably as focused as I am now in my career.
I've just heard a lot of people talk about it.
I think the principles of it are something that I definitely agree with.
But I'm looking forward to getting into it. I think while I'm traveling and while I'm doing these gigs, it's going to be a nice little connector that whole idea of control, you know, creating freedom. So it's going to be a nice little thing to do every morning. I think that will be good for the next month or so.
That'll be interesting. Maybe we can blog a little bit of, I don't know, maybe work out something like that, something cool like that.
A blog on my life.
Something
day
cool
three.
Like a blog.
Day three, struggling already. That kind of thing.
Well, I think that's it for this month. Pretty exciting, and I'm so excited about the month ahead. As always, if you have any questions or feedback that you'd like to give us, we'd love to know, you know, what you're up to, recommendations you have. Feel free to post on Facebook, get in touch with us via email, follow us on Twitter, stream us on SoundCloud, iTunes.
It's all there. So give us feedback on any of that stuff, what you want to hear in the podcast as well, whether you like something, whether you don't like something.
We love all feedback, so please let us know.
So continue to join us. That has been Podcast 7 of The Act of Storytelling. See you next month, and thanks for listening.
Thanks.